Disc 2. Belle was a nurse and put in long hours nursing terminal patients in their homes during their last days. She used her hard-earned money to pay the tuition of her children at the local Adventist school. Knowing her children were being brought up in the protective fold of her church, she felt her sacrifices were worth it. Ed converted too, donning a respectable suit for church services on the seventh day, Saturday. He followed his wife's lead in the family's religious life, as many men do. But Belle was the true, literal believer who lived the word of her Bible. She was always ready to help, and others sensed it. A series of kids who needed a break came to stay with the Blocks over the years. Like young Herbert Savage, who was not welcome in his own home, they showed up at Belle's door asking for room, board, and a new start in life. A local girl who had been raped walked 4 miles in the dark to seek out Belle's loving help. Harlan was the child most influenced by Belle and her beliefs. He grew up feeling sure of what was right and wrong. He accepted that the Bible was the literal Word of God, the Ten Commandments, an absolute guide. Harlan was confident with this ordered view of the world. He was smart, he skipped second grade, and entered his teenage years a chesty, likable boy, somehow at the center of everything, and a free spirit. Often when his chores were finished, he was off horse racing bareback with his Mexican pal Ben Cepeda in McAllen. Harlan rode a white horse, a solid white horse, Ben remembers. Harlan was daring and determined. We'd ride bareback over to my house. My mom would make us corn tortillas and jellied tomatoes. Harlan used to bring a jar along to take some jellied tomatoes back with him. Harlan was sure of himself and his beliefs. He didn't feel he had anything to prove, and Harlan couldn't be cowed. His friend Russell Youngberg remembers the time that somebody vandalized a stepladder at the Seventh-day Adventist school. Harlan and his buddy Russell were among the three suspects. The principal called them into his office and told them they couldn't play on the playground until they'd fixed the stepladder. Russell Youngberg kept quiet, but Harlan spoke right up. He was terse and to the point. We didn't do it, and we won't fix it, and you can't make us, and it ain't fair. The straight-laced principal reddened but held his tongue, and Harlan Block's Seventh-day Adventist education had approached the beginning of its end. In Harlan's sophomore year, the mysterious vandals struck again, writing obscenities on the wall of an outhouse next to the school. The principal launched his inevitable inquisition. When he got to Harlan, the boy nonchalantly allowed that he knew who'd done it, but he wasn't going to tell. For this, the principal kicked him out of school. Harlan, and apparently the whole family, were ready for a change. They moved to the neighboring town of Weslaco, a flat, square, speculator's grid slapped down on the valley floor. Its name was a crunching of its founding firm, the W.E. Stewart Land Company. At Belle's insistence, the other Block children continued at the Adventist school, but Harlan didn't want to return. He felt he'd absorbed all they had to teach him. More important, Harlan was athletically inclined, and the Adventist school did not have a sports program. He wanted to make his mark in the sport that attracted the local crowds and created excitement in Weslaco, indeed in all of Texas. Football. Harlan wanted to be in on the action, part of a team. Belle didn't like such talk. She felt Harlan should make an effort to get back into the Adventist school. And football? Well, football was a game of violence, and the games were on Friday night, the beginning of the Sabbath. So football was out of the question. Belle presented her views forcefully to Harlan, who shrugged noncommittally like all teenage boys who are being told what to do. Belle appealed to Ed to discipline the boy, to focus him back on the church and get his mind off football. Ed, who thought Adventism was all well and good, but didn't take it as literally as Belle, didn't see the harm in attending a public school. And he was excited by the idea of his son playing football. Belle was aghast. They argued, but Ed pointed out that they didn't have to decide this right away. Because of the difference in the school schedules, Harlan had a 7-month delay before he could enter Weslaco High School. So Ed bought some time and told Belle he'd talk with Harlan as they worked together hauling oil. A few years earlier, as the Depression deepened, milk prices had sagged. Oil had been discovered 40 miles west of McAllen, and Ed had a money-making idea. He bought one, then two, finally four new oil trucks. The Rado refinery in McAllen gave anyone with a truck free gasoline if they'd haul the crude from the oil fields. It made for long, grueling days, but Ed was a hard worker with a family to feed. As his sons matured, he got every one of them involved in hauling crude oil from the hill country wells to the refinery in McAllen. So when Harlan had time on his hands and was old enough, before he was old enough, Bell thought, Ed enlisted him as one of his drivers. It was brutal work, long trips several times a week, even weekends. Harlan took the remainder of the school year off to haul oil with his father. Bell was alarmed, but Harlan relished the independence and the opportunity to do man's work. He and his father shared the labor and grew close. Best friends, as Ed would later say. Harlan was the perfect number two man, ready to take over when the need arose. Ed loved nothing more than Harlan's company, and he was torn when their months of working together drew to a close. But he couldn't wait to cheer his most athletic son as he starred on the gridiron. Bell felt she was losing Harlan. He was the only black child to leave the Adventist school, so she worked hard to involve him in the day-long Sunday socials, convenings, the church held. But Harlan was good-looking and gregarious and attracted the attention of the girls. Bell was troubled by what she saw as the waywardness of her son, and she was horrified when Harlan brought home a .22-caliber rifle, a gun, in Bell's home. Harlan's friends all had guns to shoot rabbits in the fields, and Harlan wanted to have some fun. Bell came home one day to find Harlan innocently instructing his younger brothers in its use. Bell told Ed he must discipline Harlan, and Ed spoke to him, but his heart wasn't in it. What was so wrong about a Texas boy having a little gun? Bell's ideals were compromised a little more. And there were many times when Bell wasn't told of Harlan's hijinks. Harlan's brother Mel remembers when Harlan and some friends, in an attempt to make their own liquor, mixed yeast and grapefruit juice in mason jars and hid them behind a pillar in the barn. For 2 weeks those jars were exploding, Mel told me. We found this concoction dripping all over the barn. Dad thought it was funny. Mom never found out. Harlan's developing brawn made him a natural for the Westlake High football squad when he transferred there. He quickly became a star despite a certain naivete regarding the game's finer points. Leo Ryan recalled a practice early in Harlan's first season when the two of them had drawn their equipment from the team manager and were ambling out to the hard dirt field. Leo noticed that his friend was limping along on bowed legs. "Hey, big guy," he said. "What's the problem?" Harlan spoke right up. "My thighs hurt." He glanced down to a point below Leo's waist. "I sure wish I had me some of those boards you have in your thighs." Leo had to think about that for several moments before he realized that Harlan was referring to the protective pads in Leo's uniform pants. Harlan was tough. He could take it. In one game, the arch-rival Donna High School players somehow learned of the painful boils covering Harlan's back and shoulders. The Donna boys pounded on Harlan, but he didn't flinch. Harlan caught a breathtaking pass that scored the winning touchdown against Westlake's biggest rival. In fact, Harlan spearheaded Westlake to an undefeated season. With him as punter, pass catcher, and blocking back, the Panthers ground their way through every other team in the valley with an offense as dry and drab as the red dirt under their cleats. They quick-kicked a lot out of the short punt formation, and as far as Leo Ryan could remember, they had only one running play. It was called Harlan's play, which was strange in that it called for Harlan to block out for the fullback Glenn Kleckler. But when the Panthers needed an artillery strike, a pass to gain some first-down yardage, Harlan's big, milk-hauling hands were usually wide open and ready for the ball. Harlan, the middle child, loved being part of a team, going along with the guys. He was a real contributor, but not a leader or initiator. He wasn't a quarterback calling the plays or a team captain. His main job was to block for others, to be a real teammate. He played hard enough to catch the attention of the editors of the student newspaper, the Weslaco High Life. Hard-hitting, pass-catching, 165 pounds, 5 feet 11 inches, describes Harlan Block, right hand of the Panther line. Although this is his first year in Weslaco High School and his first year of athletics, he is probably one of the more natural athletes in the Valley. Harlan made all South Texas, along with Leo Ryan and B.R. Guess, in that undefeated 1942 gridiron season. Leo always felt that the team might have triumphed in the Texas playoffs if their bus hadn't been confined to the Valley by the gasoline shortage. Still, it was a team to remember. Their photograph appeared in the local papers, all open collars and parted hair and confident grins. But Bell hadn't seen Harlan's star on the gridiron. Bell insisted the family observe the Adventist Sabbath from Friday sunset to Saturday sunset. During Harlan's Friday night football game, she sat quietly at home, concerned for his soul. This proud Christian woman never could quite enjoy the way Harlan was throwing himself into life as a budding young man. She was fearful for his spirituality. She seemed to worry that she was losing him. He was playing around too much. He was always gone, Bell complained to Ed. Harlan was a hellraiser in Bell's eyes, but he was pretty tame by most people's standards. He was bashful in groups and blushed at off-color jokes. Leo Ryan said Harlan worried about his looks and never thought the girls liked him. "Y'all gone ahead without me now. I'm not going to get a date," he would tell Leo and the guys. But the girls sensed something special in him. His brother, Ed Jr., told me that the girls flocked to Harlan, and in many of the curling black-and-white photographs of Harlan that I've managed to collect, there is a happy-looking young woman standing close to him. But the dalliances were innocent, kid stuff. His favorite girl, the one many think he might have married after the war, was Catherine Pierce. "We'd go to the movies together," Catherine remembered, "and we'd go to church functions. We liked each other. We dated, but we never so much as held hands." Harlan would soon be off to war, soon be a symbol to the world of male bravado. But it's doubtful that in his short life, Harlan Block ever kissed a girl. Ira Hayes, Gila River Indian Reservation, Arizona. I came to realize that much of what there is to know about Ira Hayes can be gleaned by studying him on the flag-raising photo. First of all, his silence, his utter quietness. Sit and look at the photo for an hour, an afternoon, a day. Sit quietly with Ira's not addressing you. Then you know the utter silence that was Ira Hayes, a boy whose favorite game was solitaire. For another clue, look at Ira's position on the photo. He's the last figure to the left, the boy whose hands can't quite reach the pole. That's Ira. Different. Apart from the rest. Unable to grasp the pole, just as he was unable later to get his hands around his life. If you feel you don't know enough about Ira, you know how I felt in the summer of 1998. I had interviewed many people, school chums, ex-Marines, his three living relatives, but I still didn't have a handle on him. I didn't know who he was, what made him tick. So I flew to Arizona in search of the real Ira Hayes. And I learned that he cannot be found. I drove south out of Phoenix until I was on the Pearl Harbor Highway, as Interstate 10 is called as it nears Ira's reservation. I drove through the dry, silent heat along flat pink desert land, a plain of mesquite bushes and deep green saguaro cactus that recedes until it hits the Santan Mountains. I drove until the four-lane highway crossed a meandering ravine about 15 yards wide. A sign marked the ravine. It read, "Gila River." I pulled my car over and looked down from the highway into what used to be the Gila Riverbed. I saw only a wide, dry, empty nothingness. The Gila River hadn't flowed under that highway for decades. I gazed out at Ira's land, the Gila River Indian Reservation. It's not big, with maybe 15,000 inhabitants. Framed by the mountains in the distance, a glance gives you the feeling you can see it all. Behind me, as I stood overlooking the dry riverbed, cars, RVs, and campers of my society whooshed by. Sometimes a horn sounded to warn me not to back up onto the busy highway. The noises contrasted with the stillness, the utter silence of the reservation before me. After looking down once more at the river that wasn't a river, I got back into my car, off to find Ira Hayes. Ira was a Pima Indian, a member of a small, proud tribe that had inhabited this quiet land for centuries. He was born Ira Hamilton Hayes on January 12, 1923, to Nancy and Job Hayes. He was the oldest of the six Hayes children. Two children, Harold and Arlene, died as babies. Two other children died before they were 30, Leonard in a car crash and Vernon of spinal meningitis. Ira made it to 32 years of age. Nancy and Job lived longer than all their children except Kenny, who was born in 1931 and was 67 when I met him. At birth, Ira was already apart, separated from other Americans by law and custom. Arizona, a state for only 11 years at the time of Ira's birth, did not recognize Pima Indians as citizens. Pimas could not vote. They could not sue anyone in the courts. The home Ira was born into was a one-room adobe hut built of mesquite posts and arrowhead rock. Sturdy and economical, it faced east in the traditional way, so that each morning its occupants opening the door were greeted by the rising sun. A well-swept canvas rug covered the dirt floor. Upon it stood a wood stove, a table and chairs, iron bedsteads with corn shuck mattresses. An American flag graced one wall. Religious paintings and a Bible were always in evidence. The front of the house had a traditional vato, a shady arbor under which to relax and entertain visitors. Outside to the west stood a carrel, shed, and storehouse. Built to last for centuries, the Hayes home would still be standing today if it hadn't been destroyed by vandals in the early 1990s. Subsistence farming, cotton growing, basket weaving, the chopping and selling of mesquite branches to white town dwellers for firewood, these were the hard features of survival for most Pima Indians during Ira's boyhood. Job Hayes was a farmer, a cotton harvester, and a chopper of weeds. From Job, Ira inherited his complete and utter silence. He was a quiet man, Ira's niece Sarah Bernal remembered of Job. He would go days without saying anything unless you spoke to him first. And Kenny Hayes, Ira's only living brother, who himself rarely speaks, said only, "My dad hardly ever talked." As a little boy, as a young man, and later as an adult, Ira was a quiet person. He didn't feel any compulsion to make conversation, to break any ice. He could be in another's presence for hours, not talking, silent as the mountains overlooking his reservation. As his boyhood friend Dana Norris told me, "Even though I'm from the same culture, I couldn't get under his skin." Ira had the characteristic of not wanting to talk. And in Ira's Pima culture, being quiet and self-effacing was encouraged. "In our culture, it's not proper for a Pima to seek recognition," tribal leader Urban Giff explained to me. Or, as Dana Norris put it, "We Pimas are not prone to tooting our own horns." But Ira wasn't just quiet. He was a silent island unto himself, already separate from his other Pima friends. Yet when Ira did speak, he displayed a keen mind and an impressive grasp of the English language. It was his mother Nancy, a devout Presbyterian, who read to him from the Bible when he was a youngster. Nancy ran an ordered home, volunteered in the community, and was a pillar of the church, which was just a stone's throw from the Hayes' front door. Nancy saw to it that Ira and his siblings got the best education available. All his life, Ira devoured all kinds of books. He was the most prolific letter writer of the six flag raisers, and when it was time for high school, she sent them as boarders to the Phoenix Indian School. But Ira's literacy wasn't a rarity. His tribe had a long history of being an advanced culture compared to other Indian tribes and even white settlers. Pima means river people, and for over 2,000 years, the Pima had lived by the Gila River as successful and peaceful farmers. Before the time of Christ, they had organized an extensive network of irrigation canals to bring water to their crops. Excavations have identified over 500 miles of canals built by the year 300 BC. One book on the Pima states that they had ruins that crumbled when Rome was still young. In 1864, a group of white settlers made the first contact with the Pima. They were escorted by the commander of the Army of the West, Colonel Stephen Kearney. Colonel Kearney posted guards among the settlers as they mingled with the Pima, but as he later wrote, instead of encountering wild Indians, he was surprised to admit that the Pima surpassed the Christian nations in agriculture and were immeasurably before them in honesty and virtue. The praise is impressive, coming as it does from an unsentimental warrior more accustomed to slaughtering Indians than tipping his hat to them. But Kearney had it right. He found himself beholding a settled culture in the southern half of what is now Arizona that had brilliantly harmonized land, water, crops, and domesticated animals to create a peaceable kingdom of plenty and of virtue. Central to all this was the art of bringing water to a dry, rainless place. Over the centuries, the Pima canals drained water from the Gila and distributed it skillfully through fertile fields of wheat, corn, squash, beans, melons, and cottonwood trees. The tribe seemed to take its character from the Gila's deep, generous flow. Unwarlike and rarely invaded, Pima Indians were a sharing people who offered their bounties to other nations and in time to the 49ers and other white nomads making their way across the desert in prairie schooners headed for California. This latter gesture may have been a mistake. It drew attention to the paradise the tribe had painstakingly created for itself. In return for the Pima's generosity and even protection under attacks by Apaches, the migrating Easterners who settled in Arizona began to help themselves to the same water sources that sustained the peaceful culture. By the 1870s, and despite lip service assurances from the U.S. government, the Pima's agricultural system was disrupted. In the 1890s, agents of the U.S. Geological Survey arrived with plans to rectify the situation. But they wouldn't listen to the suggestions of the Pimas who had successfully farmed there for centuries. Instead, the United States tore up the canals and replaced them with an unworkable and destructive system. In 1930, former President Calvin Coolidge dedicated the Coolidge Dam on the Gila River. He smoked a peace pipe, a custom unknown to the Pima but gratifying to the newsreel cameraman, and declared that the dam would save the Pima Nation from poverty. The Gila's table continued to fall. Not a drop went to the Pima. And so things went, until finally the only way that one could determine that a stream had once flowed through these dry precincts was by looking at that sign beside a bridge on the Pearl Harbor Highway that promised a Gila River. The remarkable thing, given the decades of thievery and ruination of the Pimas, is the legacy of dignity and forbearance that prevails amid their exploited culture. For three quarters of a century, the Pimas had fed starving whites, protected whites against attack by other tribes, never killed a white man, and never robbed one. Moreover, they obligingly took up the names, the clothing, the religion, and the rules and regulations of their exploiters. In 1917, even though they were not U.S. citizens and thus exempt from military service, a majority of young Pima men waived this right and enlisted to fight in France. Matthew Juan, a Pima, was the first Arizona soldier killed in action in World War I, a fact all Pima young men were proud of. Ira Hayes's people are watchers and listeners, not talkers. The voices are spare as they describe Ira, usually referring to what he wasn't, as if he never revealed who he really was at heart. Ira wasn't playful, he wasn't competitive, recalled Dana Norris. Ira didn't go in for games, his cousin Buddy Lewis remembered. The other Hayes boys would tease me, his niece Sarah Bernal recalled, but not Ira. He was quiet, somewhat distant. And when they do describe a distinctive trait of his, it's always the same, Ira's total silence, his self-effacement. Ira was very shy, Buddy Lewis told me. He preferred to stay in the background. Ira didn't speak unless spoken to, said Sarah Bernal. He was like his father. Ira was a quiet guy, Dana Norris confirmed. Such a quiet guy. After grade school on the reservation, Ira went to board at the Phoenix Indian School. There he mixed with Indians of other tribes, but retained the sense of himself as distinct, a proud Pima. He'd come and hang out with his Pima friends, Dana Norris remembers. He felt most comfortable around his own kind. In 3 days on Ira's reservation, I spoke with many people who knew Ira. They told me the outlines of Ira's life. They remember the boy, but he was so totally self-contained, they just shook their heads when I asked them about Ira's attitudes, his beliefs, any distinguishing traits. Esther Monahan remembered him clearly. A fellow Pima, she attended the Phoenix Indian School with Ira. She saw him daily in their Pima homeroom. But she couldn't recall Ira's ever saying anything. Anything at all. She told me, Ira wasn't like the other guys. He was shy and wouldn't talk to us girls. He was much more shy than the other Pima boys. The girls would chase him and try to hug him like we did with all the boys. We'd catch the other boys who enjoyed it, but not Ira. Ira would just run away. In time, Ira's school day would begin with news of faraway battles. Every morning in school, Eleanor Pasquale remembers, we would get a report on World War II. We would sing the anthems of the Army, the Marines, and the Navy. Ira enlisted in the Marines 9 months after Pearl Harbor, when he was 19. His community sent him off to war with a traditional Pima ceremony. 56 years later, I was embraced by a similar Pima ceremony on my visit to Arizona. It was a dinner at the Ira Hayes American Legion Post, about a mile from where Ira's house once stood. I listened to young and old Pima speakers relate proud stories of their culture and felt the warm embrace of community we rarely experience in our Anglo gatherings. Near the end of the ceremony, I was asked to come on stage, and Eleanor Pasquale presented me with a Pima painting. In the center is the legendary Pima figure, Suhi, and in the background is the famous flag-raising photo. Eleanor, a dignified lady who knew Ira, explained the significance of the painting to me. Suhi is a stick figure in the center of a maze. The maze represents all the challenges of life, and the center is where peace and security reside. Like Suhi, if you keep going, you can find the center, your peace. And what about Ira in the background, I asked. We hope in death he has now found his peace, she answered. The peace that he couldn't find on this earth. René Gagnon, Manchester, New Hampshire. He is the figure hidden by my father in the photo. He stands shoulder to shoulder with John Bradley, only the tip of his helmet and his two hands visible. And in his life, he often remained in the background, obscured by others. He was shy, unaggressive, not a standout type of guy. He had little to say when asked a question. He never imagined life as something to grab hold of and shake. Molded by huge, unseen corporate and military forces, he saw his life as that which they decided it should be. Life was a question of luck or contact. He wasn't a man's man. He never chummed with the guys. The only steps he took in his life were at the suggestion of the women in his life, his mother and later his wife. He always lived with one of them, and other than his time in the Marines, he spent no time out on his own. He followed his wife's advice in search of the lucky break that never materialized. He listened to her until it was too late. And by then, he was trapped for good. René Gagnon arrived on March 7, 1925, the only child of French-Canadian mill workers Henry and Irene Gagnon. French-Canadians formed a dense ethnic enclave on the west side of Manchester, New Hampshire in those years, a little Canada in which French was the language and Catholicism the religion. In at least some cases, the menfolk's notions of propriety were markedly more European than the surrounding Yankee Puritan norm. René might eventually have had some siblings and a chance at a more self-assured childhood had not Irene Gagnon decided to take him for some fresh air in his stroller one day during his infancy. Their jaunt might have been unremarkable had not Irene spotted Henry Gagnon strolling along the same street. Henry was in the company of another woman. The other woman, like Irene, was pushing a stroller. In the stroller was another infant. Henry's, but not Irene's. Irene not only divorced Henry, she never allowed him back into her house or her life. She never discussed him with Renee. Renee's own son, Renee Jr., told me that he believed his father never met the old man until after he had returned home from the war. Strikingly handsome with his lean Gallic face and dark hair and brows, Renee grew up under the coddling influence of Irene. Her life consisted of her job in the mills and her son. She often brought him to work with her to show him off, to be cooed over by the other women. People remember him as a quiet boy, always in the background. He paid attention to the Holy Cross nuns at St. George's grade school, but he did little that people could later remember. His friend Jules Trudel knew him for years. They attended St. George's together. They played together, walked to school together, sat near each other in the classroom. But when asked to describe Renee or to recall any remarkable incidents, Jules could only say what people would say about nondescript Renee all his life. He was a nice guy. The Mill. Of all the six flag raisers, it was Renee Gagnon whose life was the one most defined, if not overwhelmed, by forces far larger than himself. Among these were the forces of massed corporate labor, regimented and mechanized, and given architectural form by Renee's hometown. He was born in Manchester, a heavy and sprawling industrial metropolis on the decline in the 1930s, but still the home city to the largest textile mill complex in the world. In this regard, Renee and his future sergeant, Mike Strank, two young ethnic Americans, shared a powerful formative experience, at least on the surface. Each came of age in a kind of living Thomas Hart Benton mural, a teeming workers' hive that typified the sprawl and belch of American industry in the 1930s. But in fact, the two mill towns were vastly different. Franklin Borough, Pennsylvania, where Strank grew up, was a tough coal miners' and steelworkers' town, masculine and riotous with fire and smoke and noise. The Manchester mills covered even more territory, triple lines of dark red brick buildings, each six stories high, stretching for miles below the Amaskeag Falls. But no smoke billowed, no sparks flew from these mills. For nearly a century, they had hummed sedately, turning raw thread into gingham cloth. 5 million yards of it a week at prime production, enough to put a band around the earth every 2 months. Rene probably didn't reflect on it, but he was in on the final years of Manchester's century-long epic as a cradle of industry. That epic indirectly shaped much of the boy's sense of himself in relation to the world. The Amaskeag Mills had thrived since 1819, when the advent of the power loom made the complex the largest of its sort on the globe. Manchester itself was a creature of the Amaskeag Manufacturing Company. Plotted out by its entrepreneurs in 1837, just as Westlaco was plotted out for the citrus boom in 1919. Throughout the 19th century, the Amaskeag drew swarms of textile workers to its site on the Merrimack River, about 50 miles north of Boston. Many of these were French Canadians. They poured down in trainloads, tens of thousands over the years, lured by a market for skilled labor that tapped their cultural roots. In the process, they improvised a kind of techno-corporate community, flavored and protected by the dictates of mass commercial production, accepting the benevolent control of their gigantic employer, content with its definition of them as the corporation's children. These rural men and women and their children adapted themselves to the terrain, both physical and psychological, of their new urban life. They molded to the almost medieval landscape, the harsh mill yards, the endless solid walls of factory buildings, the heavy wrought iron gates, the dwarfing scale of architecture. They took for granted the social regimentation of their lives. They accepted the notion that a kind of unseen but always attentive power ruled over them. It was the perfect spawning ground for life in a mass society, civil or military. By René Gagnon's time, Amesquig had lost its grip as an industrial monolith. The main product of its mills was cotton gingham, and by the late 1920s, consumer demand for gingham had shifted to the emerging synthetic materials such as rayon. Amesquig never saw it coming and was too unwieldy to adapt. The mills shut down. In 1937, much of the infrastructure was bought up by a group of Manchester citizens and sold off to more than 20 small independent industries. The largest of these was the Chicopee Manufacturing Company, makers of gauze and cheesecloth for such products as medical bandages. Irene secured a job at Chicopee and later brought René with her. The fortunes of the city declined, but the lucky workers at Chicopee clung tightly to their jobs, grateful for the security of employment in one more large, paternal, benevolent corporate system. None was more grateful than Irene Gagnon, who told her son how lucky she was that they had given her a job. Life inside the corporate fortress had its pleasures. A boy growing up there could bask in the glitter of company town commerce, the long shopping streets with their glowing lights and snazzy entertainments, their metropolitan bustle and flair. Thursday nights were shopping nights in Manchester, as in other workers' towns in mid-century America. Paychecks were issued on Thursdays, and the stores and banks stayed open late those nights. People got dressed up and went promenading along Elm Street, where the shops beckoned under the streetlights. I can imagine René Gagnon combed and spiffed up and checking his reflection in the plate-glass windows, hurrying along to meet his friends at the Palace Theatre on Hanover Street. He would have walked from his mother's house on Hollis Street, where the rows upon rows of corporation houses were always in view. Layered living, somebody called it. Very much like a vast military camp. At the Palace, 10 cents apiece would buy the boys 3 hours of cowboy double features, a Gene Autry and a Roy Rogers if they were lucky, plus cartoons and maybe a Buck Rogers cereal. On a Saturday morning, his gang might have joined 1,700 shrieking, jostling kids at the State Theater, an Art Deco palace with terrazzo floors, to see a special showing of Shirley Temple's new movie. He might have taken a trolley car, but he wouldn't have been driven. Manchester in the 1930s was not a car town. As a boyhood pal of René's recalled to me, on a hot summer day, if you had 10 cars come through town, that was a lot of cars. Horses and wagons still filled the streets back then, the rubberless steel-rimmed wheels grinding on the cobblestones and giving the city its distinctive noise. In the summer, after school let out in June, short pants and brush haircuts would replace knickers and pompadours. Then it would be a season of baseball, track meets, local talent shows, peanut butter sandwiches for lunch, and homemade fudge at night. Winters were even more fun. It snowed a lot in New England in the 1930s, just as it did in Wisconsin and Kentucky, and René Gagnon made as much out of the snow as John Bradley or Franklin Sousley did. The town fathers used to block off hilly Sagamore Street with wooden horses after a snowstorm and hang out kerosene lanterns for illumination, and people would come there with their sleds. Mostly children, but some grown-ups, too. On a good night or weekend afternoon, maybe 200 boys and girls would be flashing down the hill in stocking caps on their flexible flyers. When René was old enough, Irene brought him to the mills in his free time so they could be together more. He worked alongside his mother and many other women in the same vast room, performing the same repetitive tasks day after day. He was a doffer. Doffers took care of the bobbins. Bobbins were cylinders placed on spindles to receive the cotton thread as it spooled during the mechanized weaving process. There are about 700,000 spindles servicing some 23,000 looms humming along in the rows of buildings during the Manchester Mills peak year. When a bobbin was fully wound with thread, the doffer would lift it off its spindle and replace it with an empty cylinder. It was unchallenging work René could do. Irene was happy with her secure life in the mill and her tidy home. She sang the praises of this life to her son and encouraged him to come to work with her whenever he could. René began to join his mother during her lunch hour, abandoning his friends in the school cafeteria. After 2 years of high school, he dropped out so that he could concentrate on being a doffer full-time. René worked alongside his mother and her friends now. Having her boy by her side night and day must have pleased Irene. But there were other women there, younger girls who were attracted to her dark, handsome boy. Irene was particularly concerned by a young, aggressive girl who had her eye on Renee. Her name was Pauline Harnois, and she seemed to cast a spell over Irene's boy, ready to take control, which she was used to having. As her sister Anita later remembered, "Our dad gets sick at a young age, and my mother had to work in the mills. Pauline was the oldest in a family of four, and she had to take a lot of responsibility at a young age. She liked to be in control. Her position in the family, her responsibility, formed her. She was always in control." Like a leaf in the tide, Renee was swept along with whatever current took him, and he spent more time with Pauline than Irene would have liked. One December afternoon when he was 16, the world beyond the milltown broke through the routine clip-clop and spindle hum. A bunch of the guys were all in somebody's den, listening to a football game on a big Howson radio, when the voice of President Roosevelt interrupted and started talking about a date that would live in infamy. The next day, the Manchester Union Leader paperboys were brandishing editions whose headline was just one word: war. Rationing began not long after. Rene Gagnon listened to this news, read about it, shrugged, and went back to the mill and his mother and Pauline Harnois. It was all beyond his control. He kept on working. Life went on. The mill, his mother, Pauline, the bright lights along Elm Street. Rene Gagnon kept on working right up until his army draft notice arrived in May of 1943. Then he enlisted in the Marines and submitted to the third large outside influence that would mold his life. Irene didn't want to lose her boy, but she thought it would do him good to get away from that Harnois girl. What Rene didn't tell his mother was that he had already made a fateful decision. At the age of 17, he comforted the sad Pauline with the promise that he would marry her when he returned from the war. Mike Strank, Franklin Borough, Pennsylvania. He was the enigma, the immigrant who became the ultimate fighting Yank, the cerebral little boy from the tough mill town who grew up to be the proto-sergeant, the physical intimidator who turned out to be the tough shepherd of his flock, the old man of his company who would not live to see 25. Of all the six, I find him the most complex, the most elusive study in contrasts. That is, until I study the small part of him that is visible in the photograph, his right hand. Mike Strank's right hand tells me everything I need to know. He is behind and to the left of Franklin. His right shoulder is pressed against Franklin's left. Their torsos are conjoined, their arms are reaching upward. Each boy has his left hand on the flagpole, and Franklin has his right hand on it as well. But the key to the image, at least for me, is Mike's right hand closing on Franklin's wrist. It is an image of almost unbearable delicacy and gentleness. That is Mike, the protector, the veteran Marine in the group, helping the tyro. When that shutter clicked on Suribachi, it caught Sergeant Mike in an absolutely characteristic moment. He was reaching out to give support to a younger boy in the critical chain of action. Among the flag raisers, Mike is the one larger-than-life hero. When old comrades talk to me about Mike, they become young men again. A Marine's Marine is the phrase they all get to sooner or later. They speak of the strapping man. Yet violence is not the key to Mike Strank. It is not what men valued about him. What they valued, what makes their spine stiffen in admiration 50 years after the battle, was his leadership. That and his quality of love. "He was the finest man I ever knew," said one platoon mate who went on to become a national business leader. "The best of the best," said one who went up Suribachi with him. "The kind of Marine you read about, the kind they make movies about," said another. A Marine's Marine, but not because of his ferocity in combat, although he was a cool and deadly fighter. Not because he screamed, "Follow me and we'll kill a lot of nips," or ranted about dying for your country. Mike Strank earned respect by emphasizing the well-being of his young charges at least to the extent possible in the face of torrential gunfire. "Follow me," Sergeant Mike used to tell the boys in his squad, "and I'll try to bring all of you back safely to your mothers. Listen to me and follow my orders, and I'll do my best to bring you home." He was born Michal Strenk on November 10, 1919, in Jarabinia, Czechoslovakia. A friend of the family, Anne Basifi, who was born in the same small farm village, recalled that Vasil and Marta Strenk subsisted in a one-room house with a dirt floor, along with Vasil's parents and grandparents. The following year, Vasil emigrated to America and changed his last name to Strenk. Sponsored by an uncle, Alex Urina, he passed through Ellis Island and made his way to the Pennsylvania mining and steelworking town of Franklin Borough, on the Connemaw River, 65 miles east of Pittsburgh and 2 miles east of Johnstown. Franklin Borough, chartered in 1868, was at its peak population in 1920, 2,632 people. A complex built in 1898 by the Cambria Iron Company and soon to be taken over by Bethlehem Steel offered plenty of hard work for gritty, industrious immigrants, 22 open-hearth furnaces, 2 mills for rolling sheared plates, a universal plate mill, and a continuous bar mill. 3 years later, Bethlehem would add business offices, 5 blast furnaces, a billet mill, a slab mill, a powerhouse, boilers, a chemical laboratory, a sintering plant, in which iron could be heated into a steely mass without melting, and a steel car department. At their height, the Bethlehem mills and mines around Franklin Borough employed more than 18,000 workers. They clustered in soot-caked towns and villages throughout Cambria County and along the western slope of the Alleghenies. Franklin Borough became a safe haven for East Central European immigrants and their offspring. By the early 1930s, they would form a majority in the little town, a village within a village, really. They would provide 3 of the town's 6 civil officers and half the members of the Franklin Fire Department. Vasil worked the mines for 3 years before he could afford to send for Marta and the baby. They followed him to America in early 1922. 3-year-old Michal passed innocently under the portals of Lady Liberty, the most recognizable image of America until he and his comrades supplanted it 23 years later. By the end of that year, Michal had a brother, John. Pete would follow in 1925 with sister Mary, still 8 years in the future. The family lived in a 2-room rental apartment inside the Slavic enclave. The rooms were a kitchen and a bedroom. To Marta especially, this was luxury. A castle, she said, compared with what they had endured back in Jarabinia. Mike, John, and Pete shared one bed. Their parents slept close by in the other. Vasil trudged off to the mine at 3 p.m. every day in his lamp hat and fatigues, carrying a pail that had a thermos of water in the bottom and his lunch on top. He wore the same clothes all year round, returning home black with coal dust from head to toe, but proud. This was progress. Franklin Borough offered the Strank family a symbolic vision of America, but a far different one than quiet Appleton offered the Bradleys. Here was a fiery, noisy landscape of New World mechanization. The whole town could see the vast skeletal structures of the mills. Many families lived virtually next door. The mines cut into the banks of the hills completed the enveloping industrial view. Night never came to the mill town. The blast furnaces with their open hearths blazed away 24 hours a day. The day, on the other hand, could seem like a perpetual twilight. The coal dust haze from the mines formed a thick presence in the sky, blotting out the sun. The first duty for any Franklin family upon waking was to sweep the front and back porches free of the soot that had fallen overnight like black snow. A woman who grew up there remembered walking through an inch of crunch on her way to school every day. Life in the town reflected this pounding, gritty pace of constant sweat and production. When the Stranks arrived, Franklin boasted 14 beer gardens, but no church and no doctor. Yet the Eastern Europeans who toiled there did not see any of this as deprivation. For them, it was a new chance in a new and vigorous land, a chance to rise, or at least for their children to rise. They preserved their culture and their religious values in the 2-room rented dwellings where they lived under the steel mill's glare, each little apartment building a link in the improvised chain of a new community. Without realizing it, Vasil Strank might have begun the molding of his eldest son into a Marine's Marine right in the bosom of his tiny household. Mikhail, now renamed Mike, shared a bed with his brothers John and Pete. Returning from his late shift at the mine, as he did, at about 1 in the morning, Vasil seldom saw his 3 little boys awake. They would leave for school while he was still sleeping, and he would be gone to begin his shift by the time they returned. This routine could not have been easy for Vasil. His family was really the boys, his son John recalled. And Vasil abided by a strict old-world value system. Discipline in the family was paramount. When one of the boys had misbehaved, Marta would report it to Vasil upon his return home at night, and he would wake up a few hours later, along with the boys, to administer punishment. Vasil insisted on a special rule for this punishment. No matter which boy had committed the offense, all 3 would be disciplined equally. In this way, Vasil thought, he could transfer the burden of discipline from himself to the boys, make them see that they had a shared interest in the good behavior of each. Vasil probably did not know that he had intuited one of the fundamental principles of military training, in particular Marine training. Roughly 50% of procedure in a Marine basic training program is about disconnecting the young American boy from his concept of himself as a unique individual, a lone operator. He is remolded into an integer in a team. Shared responsibility, an abiding sense of the unit, is essential to survival in combat. Thus, if a recruit should faint from exhaustion during a forced march, the rest of his unit is trained to run in circles around his body until he comes to. Equal discipline. As the eldest of the 3 brothers and the brightest, his intellectual skills would soon blaze brilliantly to the surface. Mike not only grasped the concept of teamwork and equal responsibility, he became a liaison between his father and his 2 younger siblings, an explainer of his father's rules and wishes to Pete and John. In short, a sergeant. Mike Strank resembled his mother as Jack Bradley resembled his. Like Jack, Mike absorbed his mother's fervent Catholic faith. Before bed each night, he and his 2 brothers would kneel on the floor before a vivid painting of the Last Supper and say their evening prayers in Slovak. They looked out for one another. They took to making sure they wore the same color shirt to school each day, like uniforms. Slowly, the Strank family gained a foothold. While Vasil labored and Marta raised geese on the hill behind the apartment, plucking the feathers to make pillows, the boys attended school, where they picked up the new American language. Schools were good around Franklin Borough and Johnstown. Bethlehem Steele, a benevolent despot, paid for good buildings and teachers and even an indoor swimming pool, but no one could completely shield the immigrant children from nativist bigotry. Ann Bossifi, the Strank's fellow immigrant from Yarrabinia, recalls cringing on the schoolroom floor after being struck by her first-grade teacher. Her sin was unthinkingly slipping into the Slovak tongue. Mike never made that mistake. He did not know English when he began first grade. By the end of the year, he was so proficient in it that he skipped the second. He even learned to joke around in the new tongue. He took up the French horn and learned it, quickly. It was amazing, his relatives said. The boy never forgot anything. He could open the evening newspaper, read a page of it, and the next morning tell you exactly what all the articles said. A photographic memory. He was shy around girls, Ann Strank, Pete's wife recalled. Not outgoing. You would only notice him if you knew him. But then not many of the boys in that town were at ease with girls, or vice versa. Men he liked. Men he understood. And men liked and understood Mike Strank. His shyness had nothing to do with timidity. He saved his brother John's life in the mines once. It happened in 1933 when Mike was 15 and John was 11. Coal miners' children were allowed to go inside the tunnels sometimes during breaks and collect random shards of coal to fuel their family's stoves. One day Mike and John were walking along in the darkness, feeling for lumps of coal. John, trailing his big brother, was idly banging his coal shovel against the wall. On one bang, the shovel made contact with an exposed high-power wire. John screamed, but could not let go. The electricity fused his hand to the shovel. Mike spun and hurled his body against the little boy like a football lineman throwing a block, knocking him free. John fell to the ground screaming in terror, but safe from the deadly current. A few years later, during the second Johnstown flood of 1936, Mike calmly faced a current of a different kind, with most of the townspeople in near panic as the Connemaw River waters rose dangerously near the peak of the 1889 disaster. Mike calmly made his way down the steep incline to have a look for himself. Scrambling back up, looking bored and deadpan, he told his rapt little brothers, "It's gonna come and it's gonna go, and that's just the way it is." The little brothers were awed and calmed by Mike's air of detachment. By 1933, the Stranks had saved enough money to buy, for cash, a 10-room duplex on the side of a hill above the Connemaw. The family kept 5 rooms for itself and rented out the other 5. This would prove Vasil's greatest claim on the good life in America. The Stranks were living in unimaginable luxury now. When Mary came along a little later that year, she was delivered by an actual midwife. Her arrival in the family gave the 3 boys an expanded cycle of duties at night. One would wash the dishes, one would dry them, and the 3rd would take the baby out for a stroll. Jokester Mike at times would turn this into a 3 Stooges routine, slipping his dried dishes back into the sink for John to wash all over again. Games of marbles on the kitchen floor, touch football on the hard town streets, leather basketballs heaved at quivering hoops tied to telephone poles, pennies saved for baseball cards in the collection plate. At night, the 3 brothers sprawled near the kitchen stove, studying, Mike tutoring each of them in turn. Mike would help Pete and me with our homework, John Strank remembered. He'd tutor us on the floor near the stove where it was nice and warm. The good life for the Stranks began to feel as though it would never end. It seemed that the mills, like the rest of America, would keep on expanding forever, belching ever brighter flames. Franklin Borough had grown so confident of its unending prosperity that it had built a new municipal building, so opulent in its gleaming white brick, that it was nicknamed Taj Mahal. The movie had come to town, did a song and dance routine, The Depression had sunk into eastern Pennsylvania well before Mike Strank graduated from high school in 1937. Soup kitchens had replaced the bustling activity in the mines and the mills. A steelworkers' strike had failed badly. Thousands of Slavs foraged for new jobs. Pennsylvania well before Mike Strank graduated from high school in 1937. Soup kitchens had replaced the bustling activity in the mines and the mills. A steelworkers' strike had failed badly. Thousands of Slavs foraged for new jobs. The smoke, dust, grime, and blackened skies of Mike's childhood seemed permanent features of the landscape. Even for a bright boy like Mike, college was beyond hope, the costs unimaginable. His ambition, as noted in his 1937 high school yearbook, was to be president. Some workers had come to Franklin Borough while he was in high school, men who said they belonged to something called the WPA. President Roosevelt had created it so that people could work their way out of poverty. These WPA men had built a band shell in the town, sidewalks, some sewers. Mike learned that the men were being paid the impressive sum of $57 a month. He decided that he would see what Mr. Roosevelt had available for him. He ended up in a similar brainstorm of the president's, one that perfectly suited his energy and developing physique. The Civilian Conservation Corps. The CCC was designed to wean young men off street corners by getting them involved in shoring up the nation's natural environment. Through the 1930s, youthful CCC workers planted millions of trees across America. They released nearly a billion game fish into the country's rivers and lakes. They built wildlife shelters, created camping grounds, and dug thousands of miles of canals for irrigation and transportation. But the CCC had a greater function, one that did not fully reveal itself until America went to war. It served as a pre-military training experience for some 3 million boys, many of whom would flood into the armed services after Pearl Harbor. Administered by the Army, the CCC introduced its recruits to camp life, to military discipline, to physical fitness, and to a sense of loyalty to comrades and to a cause. All this was certainly true of Mike Strank. The former French horn player, scholar, and good Catholic boy disappeared into the CCC in 1937 weighing 140 pounds and reemerged 2 years later a strapping 180, tanned and handsome. He had headed first for the Petrified Forest in Arizona, then he came back to Pennsylvania, working as a laborer on highway projects for another year. He would have stayed on happily in the CCC, swinging an axe and hauling concrete under the great American sun, but the government denied his application for an extension. His father had by then found work a couple of days a week, and the family was no longer technically destitute. Mike Strank was 19 now. The year was 1939. In Europe, Hitler's legions were overrunning his Czech homeland, making slaves of his people. Mike decided to join the Marines. He didn't have to do it. He could have avoided military service altogether, given his Czech citizenship. Brother John always puzzled over the fact that the Marines allowed him in at all. Apparently, no one checked out his nationality. Mike enlisted on October 6, 1939. He was the only one of the six flag raisers to sign up before America entered the war. But soon the brainy Czech boy would transform himself into a prototype American fighting man, a tough, driven, and consummate leader, advancing without complaint toward what he came to understand was his certain death. Chapter 3. America's War. What kind of people do they think we are? Is it possible they do not realize that we shall never cease to persevere against them until they have been taught a lesson which they and the world will never forget? Winston Churchill, On the Japanese, 1942. When it struck, it must have seemed a plot twist out of some futuristic movie, but this time for real. A sleepy American Sunday afternoon in early December, Yuletide season in the air, roast chicken dinners finished and the dishes washed, family radios tuned to Sammy Kaye's Sunday Serenade on the NBC Red Network, or a great plays presentation of the Inspector General on the Blue, or perhaps the pro football game between the Washington Redskins and the Philadelphia Eagles, and then suddenly urgent bulletins crackling through static. The future had begun. The shocking interruptions started at 2:25 p.m. John Daly of the NBC Red was on the air first. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. 5 minutes rated over both NBC systems. From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt's statement today that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. I'll repeat that. Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York. As the afternoon wore on, the bulletins multiplied and a vast radio audience built, as many as 80 million listeners by one estimate. Some of them heard an anonymous announcer describing the tumultuous damage by telephone from the roof of radio station KGU in Honolulu. After a bomb narrowly missed the broadcast tower, the man screamed, "This is no joke! This is real war!" The following day, most of those same listeners, including hundreds of thousands of children, tuned in again to hear President Franklin Roosevelt intone the 6.5-minute speech whose key phrases would resound in American folklore. Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God. No joke. The real thing. Before Pearl Harbor, America had looked across the Atlantic for an enemy. Adolf Hitler was the enemy we feared, and Japan was dismissed as only a threat. But after the Day of Infamy, newspaper maps of the Pacific and Asia were scrutinized at the kitchen tables of America. Now America was in a world war, a two-ocean war. Across the Atlantic, in Europe, the U.S. would be fighting in support of and with an Allied force. But for years, Russian, English, and French troops would do most of the fighting and take the brunt of the beating. And it would be Stalin's troops who would really beat Hitler. 75% of the German troops who died fighting in World War II were killed by Russian troops. Against Japan, however, America would stand virtually alone in the Pacific. Japan had violated American soil, and the first and last American battles of World War II would be fought there. The Pacific War would be America's war. America went to war in 1991. The Europeans had been fighting since 1939. But for millions of Asians, World War II had begun a decade before, in 1931. Earlier in the century, Japanese civilians had lost control of the government to the military. Intent on making Japan into a world power, the military became preoccupied with Japan's one glaring weakness. Japan had almost no natural resources, and its industrial base was at the mercy of imports whose supply lines could be cut. Japan, they argued, had to acquire a secure resource base to guarantee its industrial security. To the military, this goal was important enough to alter the very structure of Japanese society. The entire nation had to be militarized for the goal, and military thinking and training were imposed on each citizen. The military squeezed the Japanese populace in an iron vice. On one side was a militarized educational system that prohibited free thought. Schools became boot camps complete with military language and physical discipline. Youth magazines carried jingoistic articles such as "The Future War Between Japan and America." The final examination at the Miyabashi Middle School in March of 1941 required the students to discuss the necessity for overseas expansion. It was commonplace for teachers to behave like sadistic drill sergeants, slapping children across the cheeks, hitting them with their fists, or bludgeoning them with bamboo or wooden swords. Students were forced to hold heavy objects, sit on their knees, stand barefoot in the snow, or run around the playground until they collapsed from exhaustion. The other side of the vice was a regimen of draconian thought control laws that constrained all civilians. Imprisonment and torture were the fates of anyone who questioned authority. Using the deceptively neutral term Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, Japanese propaganda claimed that Japan's aim was to free its neighbors from white colonial rule. Instead, Japan, like Nazi Germany, used a master race mentality and a highly mechanized war machine to subjugate those it claimed to be freeing. Tokyo enslaved those peoples who lacked the capacity for independence and stole their national resources. The Japanese attitude of superiority is evident in a document from the Imperial Rule Assistance Association entitled Basic Concepts of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. Although we use the expression Asian cooperation, this by no means ignores the fact that Japan was created by the gods or posits an automatic racial equality. The nation created by the gods initiated co-prosperity by raining terror down on Manchuria and China. With official approval and chilly detachment, the Japanese army bombed Chinese cities and slaughtered everyone in its way, including unarmed men, women, and children. Japan's first conquest was Manchuria in 1931. Then, to consolidate control of Manchuria, Japan attacked China in 1937. The Japanese army employed ruthless tactics in China. Japanese airplanes bombed defenseless civilians. Rats infected with deadly bacteria were systematically released among the populace, making Japan the only combatant to use biological warfare in World War II. The Japanese army raped and pillaged with full encouragement from its superiors. But China is a vast country, and despite millions of casualties, Japan's war became a debilitating war of attrition. And Japan's relations with China's allies, especially the U.S., became strained. Then, in 1939, war in Europe appeared to offer Japan a fortuitous way out of its dilemma. Awed by the German blitzkrieg into France in May of 1940, Japan's military leaders calculated that Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941 would be successful. They argued that now was the time to capture other resource-rich Asian countries. Japanese militarists reasoned that the U.S. and the U.K. would be preoccupied by the German thrust and would not dare to allocate large military resources to Asia. Hawks argued that the American public would not support a long war far from its shores. A slowly tightening American economic boycott of critical exports to Japan hastened the decision to act. Japan's principal war aim was the conquest of European colonial empires in Asia. These empires would give Japan the resources it needed and fostered a hope that a surrounded China would capitulate. With a thoroughly militarized citizenry, an experienced army, and an immense navy, Japan was confident it could control the Pacific as its sphere of influence. After disabling the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor, Japanese forces thrust southward toward Australia, overrunning Wake Island, Malaya, Singapore, the Philippines, and what is now Indonesia. Japanese forces soon controlled the Pacific battlefield. Only Australia and the South remained unconquered. The Japanese Army had even humbled the United States Army. On December 7th, hours after hearing the news from Hawaii, General Douglas MacArthur sat in the Philippines, stunned, seemingly unable to give a command to mobilize the largest fleet of warplanes in the South Pacific. When nearly 200 Japanese bombers arrived over Manila 10 hours after the Pearl Harbor attack, they simply obliterated this fleet, which sat in convenient clusters on the tarmac. MacArthur was soon forced to withdraw 65,000 Filipinos and 15,000 American troops from a defense of Luzon and into the mountains of the Bataan Peninsula. They retreated in the face of a converging Japanese naval and infantry force. President Roosevelt, realizing the Bataan defenders were doomed, ordered MacArthur, America's most decorated soldier of World War I, to flee by boat to Australia under cover of darkness. The battling bastards of Bataan, as the trapped troops styled themselves, held out starving until April 3, 1942, Good Friday. They surrendered, the most crushing defeat in American military history. The emaciated survivors were driven 65 miles on foot for 3 days in lacerating heat to a prison camp, the infamous Bataan Death March. Some 15,000 prisoners perished en route. They succumbed to thirst, starvation, exposure, and the merciless abuse of the Japanese soldiers, who whipped, beat, and shot those who stumbled or paused to lap at water in some roadside stream. But if the men in charge of America's Pacific forces were temporarily stunned by the onslaught, America's boys were spoiling for vengeance. Robert Leader, who later served with John Bradley in Easy Company, recalled his youthful indignation on that shocking Sunday afternoon. "We were so mad at the Japanese for bombing Pearl Harbor. They bombed on a Sunday, we went to school on Monday, and they piped in President Roosevelt's date of infamy speech. A bunch of us boys got together and said, 'Let's join up.'" He added, "I was never interested in killing people, but I believe that our country had been violated." Hundreds of thousands of his contemporaries believed likewise. Enlistment centers were overwhelmed by the flood of eager enlistees. The entire nation, in fact, seemed overnight to have snapped out of its Depression-era lethargy.
End of Disc 2.